What did Amazon and Google do for the first 10, 15 years of their existence? One thing, sold books. Well, that wasn't their goal, to sell books forever. They used that as a tool to learn how to do everything else.
Yeah.
Same with Google, right? Started with search, a blank page, a little box. You could only type something in. No one understood the business model. Focus. You have to focus like relentlessly in the beginning. Otherwise, you run out of money.
Hello. Today, I'm talking with and learning from James Dawson and Richard Doherty. And we're in their studio in London because we have just recorded an episode of their podcast with me as their guest. Now, James is the founder and owner of Humble Grape, so a London-based chain of wine bars. I think it's the third largest restaurant wine bar chain in London. And what he's done is a really interesting thing. He's taken wine, he's cut out the middleman, he's gone direct to independent winemakers. And so it's great wine, great food without the snobbery. And Richard Doherty's joined him on the other business which he has, which is really what we're going to talk about today, which is their business helping people sell. So they help fintech businesses go into the enterprise. And so what we're going to tease out today is some sales lessons for everybody else. So that's their speciality. But lots of the sales process, we're going to talk about Medic. We're going to talk about how you pull together sales and marketing. Fantastic conversation with Richard and James. Some great operators. I really enjoyed it. Learned a lot. I'm sure you will too.
Hey, good to be on the show, Don. Thanks for having us here. My background is sort of 20 years in financial services. 10 of those years spent a big consulting company, Accenture, driving out and leading some really amazing projects across the UK and also Europe. Jumped out of there and set up my own consulting business, which I ran for the next 10 years. Uh-huh. Same sort of thing. Actually, working in big financial companies, investment banks, tier one, tier two, tier threes, helping them on their transformation agendas. Then at the same time, went into the fintech space, started helping smaller players actually build up their organizations and scale into the bigger banks and land some nice deals. I exited that about 12, 14 months ago, and recently jumped in with Mr. Dawson here at Humble Tech, which is like absolutely amazing business because it's solving the one problem that fintechs need to solve, which is all about how do you move on from founder-led sales to enterprise sales. One more thing about me is I'm sorry to hog the mic. I really want to do this.
I really want to do this.
I'm a sort of avid cyclist, and I do a lot of Audax cycling. And at the end of this year, I'm doing London Lands in London. Raised some money for an amazing charity, which is
only 500 miles or 1,000 miles or something like
yeah.
that. Right?
So, yeah. That's it. And I'll be quiet for this show.
there's an event that I'm doing, Ride 25.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Run by John Redmond. Last year I did Geneva to Milan. This year we're doing Milan to Rome.
Oh, nice. Beautiful.
September, you should come.
Ah, okay. Sounds cool.
James, who are you?
Hi, James.
Why are you here?
Yeah, I'm James Dawson. I'm the founder and CEO of Humble Technology. And as Richard said, we solve this very specific problem of helping businesses transition from founder-led sales to scalable sales engines. So we work with scale-ups, predominantly in the fintech space, because that's my experience. I've been a fintech CRO, I've been a fintech CEO, I've scaled multiple businesses from 0 to 10 million. And that's, in my opinion, that's the hardest. The 0 to 1 million, the 1 to 5, the 5 to 10, that's absolutely brutal. It takes a certain kind of skill set and very different mindset to do that than it is to take a company from 50 to 100 or 100 to 500. I'm also obsessed with wine. And because I'm so obsessed with wine, I've started a whole hospitality business back in 2009. And now I have 6 wine bars all over London, and we import our own wines and we run wine tastings, and we've got amazing organic food and organic wines. And then I also love South Africa. So I bought a South African restaurant group called Vivat Bacchus. Uh-huh. And we do beautiful, huge, enormous steaks, ostrich, crocodile, you know, like kind of African, South African style sauces and barbecue style. So yeah, I love business and I love selling and I love talking to people about business problems.
Fantastic. What's the biggest challenge in your restaurant business at the moment?
Profitability. So ever since Brexit, we've lost access to a huge talent pool that went back to Europe.
Yeah.
And our staff costs that were traditionally 30% of revenue are now sitting at 34, 35. They're going up to 38 with this
and
new
level. And you
never
made more than 5% margin in the first place. So that's where it's all gone.
Yeah. So in a hospitality business, if you turn over $1 million and you're running it very, very well, you're lucky if you get to keep 50 grand.
Yeah.
Because 30% goes to staff, 30% goes to rent, you know, energy bills, all that kind of stuff, and 30% is cost of goods. But since Brexit and how everything's changed, now our staff is 34, 35, energy's up, rent's up, everything's up. So most hospitality business, if they're lucky now, are breaking even or making between 2 and 5% net margins. So it's a brutal landscape to be in at the moment, and everyone's fighting for survival.
And so you were delighted with the budget?
I was delighted with the budget because I only have to find an extra 450 grand this year to pay for that. So on my little 8 million turnover,
it's not a growth agenda for you.
I've told my guys they just need to sell more wine and it's all going to be fine.
Is that the mix food and wine? Is the profit on the drinks?
So the margins are similar, but executing the food is a lot more cumbersome and there's a lot more waste on the food side. So there's a lot more manual labor input into taking a 20 or 30 pound dish from the kitchen to the floor than taking a 30 pound bottle of wine and just opening and pouring it. So there's a huge cost differential there. So you know, even if your margins on food and wine are similar, your food business is very unprofitable compared to the other side, and the one carries it.
Right.
And today, with all the complexity and all the nightmares and costs going up and up and up and up, if you're a business that doesn't have another string to your bow, another revenue string, so if you've got a decent dish location and you're not also doing lots of delivery, or in our case, in Humble Grapes' case, lots of retail wine where people take wine off premises, if you don't have that additional revenue stream, and we also do tons of events, you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
In hospitality, especially if you're not in London, where people are they're not immune to all these price rises and stuff. But if you're out in the sticks somewhere and you've got a restaurant and they put the budget up and you can't do delivery or have an additional revenue stream somewhere, hospitality is in a dark place.
Okay. Mm. So back to
doom and gloom, man.
Yeah.
He's like, I love it. I had to talk you to Richard.
The fun guy.
So I am, I'm a founder of a scaling business, right? You guys must see the same types of challenges all the time. You know, what are some of the top few challenges that, you start talking to a CEO and you're like, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, so the financial technology CEOs, people who are building product, enterprise sales startups, or maybe they're selling data or AI or consulting, they're all selling to big enterprise.
Are these CEOs mainly on the technology side themselves? Have they ever been sellers themselves?
So most of them are, they come from a product background or a technology background, or they may be commercial, but they're coming out of a big business where the commercial background was providing access to liquidity or pricing, and they had a huge brand behind them like JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank. Mm-hmm. So they weren't actually selling, they were providing access.
Yeah.
And now they're in a position where they have to sell something from an unknown brand into a big corporation, and it's like there's very, very few people who can make that transition.
Well, it's hard from all that resource to no resource, all that brand to no brand.
Exactly.
I mean, when I went from Rackspace to IT Lab, it was like, oh, nobody will take my call anymore.
Nobody,
right? Yeah. Nobody.
No one cares about me.
Nobody cares who I am.
But just to go back to the challenges, and these guys, they have challenges, right? And one of the big things that we see is, They come from Goldman or JP, and they go and they've raised Series A, Series B, and there's pressure for immediate results.
Yes.
So what do you do, right? You can either sit back and try and figure out, you know, strategize and figure out, you know, how you're going to build whatever organization you want to build, i.e. figure out what game you're playing, mm-hmm. or you can run in the right with the Wild West. And a lot of the times, you know, delivering things day in, day out, this is what happens. And it means that, you know, the guys don't really get what they don't really build what they want to build. They build what they, in a way, have to build.
Yeah.
And then there's the question of, do you actually really like the business you built? Do you actually really like what you're doing? And you said they sit back and they're like, well, yeah, you know, we made a few mistakes here and there. So I think the immediate results thing is a big thing. The other thing is mindset and really understanding what an obsessive growth mindset means to a startup and a scale-up, because it's slightly different to Goldman's and JP Morgan. The mindset's different, right? You have to change. And the last thing is recruitment. Again, very, very different in a big organization to a scaling organization.
Yeah. Very difficult to hire very good people into a startup. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah, these big challenges.
If you don't get obsessed about how to make it work.
Yeah. These three, I mean, they circle around all the time. If leaders don't grapple with that and really, like, really get obsessed with trying to answer those questions, not try to answer them quickly, but try to answer them in a way that creates rules with inside their fields so they can actually play their game, then, like, in a way, they're going to hide into nothing. And that's sort of where we get involved. We help them create that level playing field, build those rules and build those systems.
So where do you want to start? Like, should we dive into obsession about growth and what that means?
I mean, I think to start, it would be, yes, you have to have that. But to start, you have to know how I've got a small business with very limited resources. Yeah. How am I going to get A players here? Uh-huh. And for me, there's three things that are super important, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. You're going to get equity. That's going to be interesting. B, you're going to learn so much more here than you ever would anywhere else, because we are growing at, like, absolute pace.
Warp speed.
Like, we're growing at warp speed. And three, you're going to get to change the world. If you stay somewhere else, big job. Company, you're going to get paid well. You're going to be a little cog. If you're interested in those things, three things, and then I always say this, the last thing, if you want to come and help me build a business, then I want you on board. But if you want to come here just to make a mission and money, then this is probably not the right job for you, because startups are too hard for people who think they can just come in and get paid well.
You may or may not know this, but you've just outlined what there was a Harvard Business Review article, which was the anatomy of high performing salespeople.
Okay.
And you've just outlined
because
you didn't say earn lots of money. What you said was influence, learning their craft, right? The changing the world, right? You know, so there, or maybe Dan Pink, you know, if you think about Dan Pink's book about motivation, you know, same, it's the same thing. It's, and then you've got to work out how to get that across to people.
Yes. Yeah, and you've got to be pretty inspirational and motivational and the real deal if you want to hire A players into a tiny startup, right?
And fewer better people.
Yes. Yeah, in the beginning.
I don't think you need lots of people right now anymore. I think fewer better people, but you also have to be interested in learning different ways of doing things, right? So as an example now, I mean, Dawson and myself, like, we're a team of two, right? And, you know, how do we, you know, we ask ourselves the question, we push ourselves all the time. How do we get a 10x multiple in our business, right? And, like, we go down rabbit holes, which is fine. It's like, we go down the AI rabbit hole. We go down, you know, different types of reading. We read about ultra learning, so we can learn much, much quicker than everyone else. So we go down these rabbit holes.
And by 10x, you mean valuation or impact?
Impact and resource, right?
Okay, right. So how can you impact more people more quickly?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Our clients need to be absolutely delighted with what we're doing.
Yeah.
That's how we're going to build this business. All the clients that have come to our workshops or worked with us, they love working with us. They see huge value for their business. Mm. That's the core principle. There's too many consultants who are charging tons of money and rocking up and spending a whole lot of time and billing 50 grand a quarter or whatever and not delivering any value.
Mm. Well, and also that I find that often they don't want their clients to
reach escape velocity.
Because, they need to.
Yes.
Right? Because it's like they want to keep them sort of not very good because they have to then keep them on the payroll. I mean,
you are really,
right. You know, you've got a problem, let's turn up. You were never going to teach you how to solve this problem because then you'll stop. We'll have nothing to bill you for, right?
What's that? Dig for water and once you've found it, stop.
Yeah. So I haven't mentioned this before, but I mean, obviously I was at Accenture and I loved it. I loved all the people I was working with, all the clients we worked with. But it did get frustrating at points where you're sitting down, you're like, yeah, I've been here for like, you know, in this client for, you know, a number of years and I'm still here producing the same PowerPoint decks. You know, what's going on? When I jumped out, and I wanted to solve that problem personally, I was like, yeah, I actually want to have real impact. I want to make certain that, you know, when I go into a client site, you know, P&L goes up or, you know, risk is reduced or cost is driven down. So when I jumped out and started doing stuff myself, that was my only, like, you know, method was make certain that there's impact. And, you know, then you flip around. I was on one client site and the COO at Standard Bank, you know, she said to me, okay, Richard, we aren't JP Morgan, we aren't Goldman's, you're going to have to do this project and you're going to have like, you know, half the budget of the other guys, solve the problem. Okay, fine, let's try and solve the problem. We solved the problem. What did we do? We like really scaled down. Like we only had a team of 15 or 20, but like 15 or 20 people that knew what the hell to do and how to execute.
Yes.
And I think then that's when you get a sort of massive value. And then I think like if we flip it around to Humble Tech, you know, there's two of us, but two of us integrate into a team. And because we go out and research stuff all the time, we can add that 10x value. And all of a sudden a team that's, you know, 15 or 20, they're producing 10x value in their client size, right? Because they've got the tool, they've got the thinking, they've got the mindset that sort of moves them beyond the others in the market who are just doing the same. And which I think is really interesting, is a really interesting way of looking at things because the big guys are the big guys and the smaller guys are the guys that actually shift the needles, right?
Yes.
They move from left to right. Yeah, yeah. There's no sort of dirt in the middle. It's either win or lose.
Yes.
And we want to be winning all the time.
Yeah. What have you got some good examples of where clients have done interesting things around to attract talent?
Where my clients have done interesting things to attract talent is to kind of almost hire people ahead of where they are now.
Okay.
So everyone
far ahead?
Yeah, everyone wants to go and hire a sales leader who's done it and knows exactly how to do everything. But those people, when you bring them into a startup, they have to go back to basics and start doing stuff like they did it 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really work. So
they don't like to do the carry in the bag thing anymore.
They don't. So when my clients now, I try and convince them, like, what you should be doing is getting someone younger, hungrier, who hasn't quite done that yet, but who we collectively feel has the ability.
Has the career momentum.
Because there's nothing worse than someone, Johnny did 100 million in revenue for XYZ. Yeah, but he's been sitting at the top of the mountain for 5 years. He's not hungry anymore.
Yeah.
Like he can't help you. He's not interested in helping you. If you pay him a ton of money, he'll come and sit there for a few years.
Also, do you see this challenge in terms of, you know, you talked about sort of, you know, 0 to 1, 1 to 5, 5 to 10. There is, you know, and you talked about, you know, the challenge of somebody coming from something like JP Morgan.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's like at JP Morgan, that person never created a process.
Never.
What they did is they turned up and they learned to optimize it in a micro way.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, like we could all go and get a job in
and
Dell.
And tell the story.
Yeah, we could all get a job at Dell because we can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? And they have a process.
Mm.
But you need somebody who goes, I can create some process out of your chaos.
Yeah.
I get a kick out of, and I also know how to do it. And over the years, I've been amazed. I would say, you know, maybe 1 in 10 sales leaders, I would say, blank sheet of paper, create £1 million of GP.
No.
And like 9 out of 10 of them go, I don't even understand the question. And one of them goes, oh yeah, no, this is like, and so it's that, how do you go and help recruit for that?
So the conversation we had earlier when you said 85% success rate based on your methodologies, I'm really interested in that. That's amazing because in my experience, like our fail rate is high, hiring salespeople and sales leaders, 40% of the time we get it wrong.
Right.
Despite all my experience, I've hired hundreds of salespeople, I've managed big sales teams. I have a lot of questions I ask around, are they curious? You know, are they intelligent? Do they read widely? Are they into podcasts? Do they have that growth mindset?
Yeah.
Are they going to be a good team player? There's a whole bunch of stuff I use.
Hustle?
Looking for hustle. Yeah, we're looking for that burning desire to be successful, right? Which speaks into that. So despite all of that and all my experience, I still get it wrong 40% of the time.
And where do you
but think what I do differently is for the first 3 months, I don't care if that person who we've just hired is in a business where the sales cycle is 18 months or 24 months or whatever. I don't care. After 3 months, if they're not doing, expressing and showing all of the activity and the habits and behaviors that I think and know that'll make them successful, if they're not doing that after 3 months, there's a very quick conversation. You've got 1 month to course correct. And if that doesn't happen, then it's not going to work out.
So what are those activities? What are those leading indicators that you're looking at? Because again, if you're the CEO of this business and you've never run a sales team, then I've hired the guy.
Yeah.
This happens a lot. I've hired the guy. It's an 18-month sales cycle.
Yeah, you can't wait 36 months.
But they're thinking, I'm going to have to wait.
Yes.
Right? And he's telling me he's doing all the right things and I don't know what the right things are. Yeah. So I'm,
So there's a bunch of stuff I do. Like one of the things I like is I need to see a lot of activity from a new salesperson or sales leader, spending time with the product teams, spending time with the tech teams to make sure that they've taken extreme ownership on understanding like how that product works, how the tech stack fits together, all that kind of stuff. So that they're not just someone who opens doors and then rolls in a tech guy to explain everything the whole time. So that's the first thing I want to see. Like within very quickly, I want you to be able to talk to me about the solution a lot to business people and quasi technical people, so you don't constantly have to have someone else with you. So that's the one thing. Secondly, I want to feel that you have the right culture, that you fit with the culture of this business, and that changes differently. Thirdly, I want to feel like you're a team player, like you're going to help other people, you're going to make them successful. It's not all about you, you know, like that guy.
Yeah.
Or
lots of salespeople are like that. Yeah. That's okay if they're in a team, but in a smaller business,
it's really hard. You can have one rock star who might be able to sell, who's constantly pissing everyone else off. Just going to ruin the whole thing. You can't have that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, are they fitting in? Are they showing up? Are they consistent in like what they've told me they're going to do? Are they getting sufficient meetings? All that kind of stuff. And then I just get a feeling like, because I call them a lot and spend a lot of time with them. And if I feel like, okay, so tell me about those last 10 meetings you did. Did you send meeting reports out? What do you mean, meeting reports? Send meeting reports out so that you can tell the rest of the team how the meeting went, what the customer thought about this issue. Oh, no, I didn't do that. Okay, so how are we supposed to come together as a team and sell if you're a senior salesperson or sales leader and you don't have that kind of behavior and you don't think it's important?
Yeah, and it's part of somebody's habit.
Yes.
It's a habit, isn't it? It's like they're unlikely to come up with new habits on their own.
Yeah.
You want people who've they work in a particular way before they come to you.
Exactly. But to your point earlier, it's like, okay, you've just joined. Here's a list of 10 things. These are the behaviors I want to see you do. Okay, make sure you do them.
Yep.
Like, I want over communication to be. I want to know exactly what you're doing the whole time until we've built a lot of trust. And then after that, I'll let you do your own thing.
Are these sellers in your world, are they prospecting themselves? Do they have an SDR team?
A lot of them in early stage companies and scale ups, a lot of people are bringing their relationships and prospecting for new ones and selling and like doing the whole gamut from SDR, business development, small sales, big deals, all the way through to the end. So you've got to have someone who's entrepreneurial, has hustle, can cope with big amounts of complexity, is comfortable working in a startup, is comfortable with lots of failure, and is also comfortable with product market fit not quite being there, right?
Yeah.
And that's difficult. Most people can't deal with that.
And where do they go, these people? Do they stay on this business for the journey to a certain point and then they drop back and they go and do it somewhere else? Or Does some of them want to be the sales director, CRO?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Almost all of them want to be the sales leader.
Right.
But then it depends whether they can get there. But I mean, even if the three of us had this question with ourselves, what kind of an animal are you? Are you a startup animal? Are you the 0 to 50 guy? Are you the 50 to 100? Are you the 100 to a billion? I don't think you can be all three. Very few people can do that.
Yes.
And you have to be honest with yourself. And it's the same with salespeople. Are you a startup sales guy, or are you a sales guy that rocks up at a company where the product market fit is very well defined and there's a playbook and you just go and execute and they've got SDRs giving you leads and you've got someone booking you meetings? Different salespeople, right?
Yeah. Different motivation.
Totally different motivation.
Let me interrupt the conversation just for a minute because I don't want you to miss this. My new book, Mind Your Fucking Business, is out on Amazon. If you're thinking yet another business book, I think you're wrong. This is actually a blueprint to cutting through the noise and achieving unparalleled success for you. It's based on 10 years of business coaching, spotting similar problems that people have had and coming up with real world solutions. If it's supercharging sales, if it's mastering talent acquisition, building a powerhouse brand, cultivating a company culture that breeds success, then this book is a ticket to your transformative journey. It's filled with practical tools and frameworks that I use every single day with my clients as part of their coaching program. If you want to take your business from good to great, look, you can go to Amazon and you can buy it, or you can click the link in the show notes and head over to monkhouseandcompany.com. I'll send it to you today. I'll send you a copy for free. I want to help you build a fantastic business. Now, back to the conversation.
And as you, I think you used the word entrepreneurial, there's that and hustle.
Yes.
Like there's that sort of wanting to solve this problem and wanting to be a team player.
Yeah.
One of the questions that we ask is, you know, early on, like even before they come in, is give us an idea of how you, when you come into the business, what are you going to do to generate pipeline conversations, pipeline generating conversations? And if the answer is have a coffee with my relationships, you're like, okay, well, that's interesting, but is it something that's going to move the needle?
Basics. What are you going to do after week two?
Yeah. So I think these things are, you need to have those, you know, conversations early on. Also, like another thing that I think is also quite important, is understanding the person.
Yeah.
Like, who is Dom? Who really is Dom, right? And how do you do that when you're sitting opposite a person that maybe you've only met one or two times, right? And I quite like asking the question, you know, what does success look or feel like for you?
Yeah.
And sometimes people go, okay, success means I'm going to make $1 million this year and I'm going to buy Ferrari and blah, blah. And then you get those characters, which are fine, right? You get, you know, which is, that's what success looks like. And then you get other people that mean, they say, listen, actually, success means I'm going to do some great stuff in this business, but also I'm going to do some great stuff for my son. My son is dyslexic, and over the next 6 months, I'm going to help him, you know, scale up in his reading so he can, you know, have an opportunity to pass at 11 plus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then you're like, interesting. So that person's Dom now is interesting. He wants to build a business, but he's also got empathy. And I need empathy in my business because my clients need empathy.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, the stars are starting to align, yeah, right? And then there's a connection, right? And then, you know, we can go off and we can start doing some nice stuff together. So I think there's a lot of that needs to happen before. And lots of times people don't do that because they want to get someone in the door because they've got to sell because, you know, they've just raised 10 million. Yeah. It's like, it's, you know, take two steps back before we take five steps forward, right?
Yeah.
And are you first person you hire?
Yeah.
Leader or first seller?
First seller.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are you hiring him? Do you care if he never becomes the leader?
I don't.
Okay. No, nor do I.
I don't. I care about the business being successful.
But quite often people are, I'm going to hire.
Attached. They're attached to that.
Well, they're like, if I hire this guy, then I don't have to hire somebody else, right? Because this guy will get promoted. And often the person who comes through the door wants that job.
Yeah,
and it's like, don't hire for the job that doesn't exist. It'll only exist if this person can sell. Let's make sure we hire somebody who can make us be successful in the seat.
That's a brilliant question. I mean, almost every CEO wants to eventually give sales to someone else. All of them.
Well, all of the ones who don't come from a sales background. Yeah, which is most of them.
Just most of them, right? So they want to hire someone to take that problem away from them, and that's where the fundamental flaw in thinking happens. Is so every time I meet a CEO, I'm like, okay, imagine you're my client, Dom. I know you know you're a tech guy and you don't like selling, but like if we want to be successful, I've got to teach you how to sell and find this product market fit and how to write the sales playbook so that we can then use that experience to do a few deals, do some learning, and then go and find someone who can do what we did together. Yes. We can't just hire someone and hope they can do something we haven't done yet.
Yes.
That's where the problem comes in.
We've had this, right?
Yeah.
We've had these car crashes. You know, they come into being on board as a new client, and you know, like they're very skeptical because they've been in this position before. Like, okay, well, why have you been in this position before? Because I listened to Jack or Jill, and they said I should hire a sales leader. I paid the sales leader $250,000. And, you know, a year later, I've got nothing. I've got absolutely nothing.
I've seen it so many times.
And these people are like, you know, found that, you know, they're fragile. They're like, they're a wreck. And you're like, okay, well, how the fuck can we help them? I mean, James told me an amazing story a couple of weeks ago. Actually, this lady was on our podcast. He helped, you know, his founder raise some, you know, nice $10 million series, I think it was, I can't remember. And she had been in this position, right? And she was sort of super skeptical of the help that we could give them. But we started going down and really helping her. And, you know, what did we get out of it? Initially, we got nothing out of it because we just wanted to help her.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing to want to help people.
Yes.
You know, people wanting to help people, that's how the world should be, right? And then later on, yeah, they became a nice client, and James more immediately did stuff with him. But I think that's the thing, right? You need to move from this, you know,
transactional
world to a world of value.
So thank you for bringing that up, because this is selling has changed so much in the last 20 years. Customers are so sophisticated. They've got everything at their fingertips. They can do all the research. They don't have to go through a book to pick a supplier. So selling today is like if you're in sales, you have to add tons of value to your client, right? Like tons and tons of value without ever expecting anything back. It's all about your client being successful. If you can have that and genuinely operate like that with that empathy that Richard was saying earlier, and whether someone ends up working with you or not, adding value to them, whether they end up buying your product or not, helping them in a way, helping them with their business or their thinking, or, you know, getting them people or whatever it is that you do for them, then I believe that the universe will take care of you.
And that's sort of the mindset of the seller that you need.
Yes.
Which is not in my experience, is not the guy who wants to make £1 million
no.
to get the Ferrari.
Exactly.
He's going to sell anything to anybody.
He does.
And doesn't care about the customer. So the question that I got from a lady called Jill Garrett, who used to be MD for Gallup in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, I often use Gallup strengths to look at, you know, people's underlying motivation and drivers. Mm. And she said, look, Dom, ask people what's the best deal you've ever done?
Yeah.
And then when they say, what do you mean? You say, don't qualify. Just go, no, whatever it means to you.
Yeah.
And then that $1 million guy will say, oh, I did this $1 million deal.
Yeah.
Right? Or somebody will say, well, I did this deal and the impact it had on the customer or the customer's customer. And the motivation just flows and they can't help themselves give you the right answer. Mm. But I also think that CEOs wanting to give sales away.
Yes.
Right. And so often it's actually the reason that somebody's buying from that small business is because when they meet the founder, he's got the vision in his head. Yeah, he turns up at JP Morgan FinTech and he's, why would they buy from him? Well, they're buying from him.
They're buying him.
Right? And you know, because I often say to CEOs, look, if you want to replace yourself with a seller, now, you know, you can't afford it. You're going to have to pay them £250,000, £350,000. You've got gravitas.
Yeah.
And you need to buy that because of or you can put in another seller that's going to do some of the thing that you don't like, opening the doors, right? And
smaller deals, that kind of stuff.
Bring you in and then you can create the playbook. And
correct.
The thing here is, you know, if we take a look at like James, I'm sorry, going to kick me out of the desk. If you take a look at like Mungo and the longevity of their careers, and we ask ourselves a question, or why are they still around? Okay, well, why is one of them still around? Yeah, yeah. And the answer that comes immediately to my mind is patience. Okay, yeah. So they are patient, right? They're patient, they know what game they're playing, they know the blueprint, and they're going out and they're executing, right? So why can't we as CEOs, founders in a startup, you know, learn a bit from that, right? Be patient, be sort of militant in the way we are operating, and make certain that we, in a way, playing the long game, because that's where the value happens. You don't, you're going to raise, which is fine. But, you know, if over time you can build something absolutely amazing that has an impact on your ecosystem, on the people that you employ, on the customers and the world, that's going to be cool, right?
And you can't help being successful.
Yeah. Well, I had Fred Reichelt on the show.
Yeah.
And he said, he's made more money out of his stock picks than he has been at Bain. And he said what he does in every industry, he picks the company that has the best customer experience. So in car rental, it's Enterprise, and in, you know, it's Amazon. So he's got this Fredster index, which he updates every year. And it's like, these are the stocks in every industry. And he said, because over time, customers will move from the company.
Yeah.
You know, there's a sort of a net promoter score gradient. Yeah. People will move to a company with better customer experience over time, long game.
Yeah.
Right. And you end up, you know, if your revenue success comes from great customer experience, I don't think you can do that by building a crap business.
Exactly.
Right? You can't hire crap employees. They can't have a crap experience. Yeah. The customer experience is never better than the employee experience. That's the, you build something you're proud of over time. But what I find interesting is people are in a hurry, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know, there's something about sales which gets in the way, right? Because in other things you'd go, oh, look, there's the wheel. That's brilliant. Like, let's not invent our own wheel, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Somebody goes, oh, agile software methodology, or, you know, like there's, you can adopt a thing. You can look at something where sales, it's like, oh.
It's true, actually.
And it feels like it's, particularly for the people who've never been in sales, you know, because quite often I'm interviewing people on the podcast who are in sales. And right. I say, look, you know, when you told your mother you were in sales, like it's not like you've said I'm going to be a doctor or a lawyer. People are like, oh,
yeah,
oh,
yeah,
I don't want to shake you, like you've obviously got no other discernible skills, so you ended up in sales. And that's somewhere the CEOs are like, I want to get rid of it, or and also I'm not going to ask for help on how to do this.
Yeah.
Like they know they don't know how to do it, but in other bits of the business, like product and development, you know, people seem to be much. It's much easier for them to go out and find help.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because when we start working with a client, the very first thing we do is we delve into psychology.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about sales? Did you have an uncle who was selling secondhand cars, or a cousin who is like always selling stuff off the back of a truck? I've got these microwaves, these mobile phones. And how did that make you feel? And then I take them on a journey. We get them to understand like the core principle of like value-based selling and about making your client successful. And if your golden star is like, we're going to make our customers successful, we're not going to sell to anyone who doesn't need our product. And we're going to only sell to people who genuinely benefit from it, and who can, and our product's going to make a massive impact on their career, their business, their life. Then we'll sell. And if that's your true North Star, then you should be very proud of selling. And secondly, as a salesperson, you are, as an individual contributor, the only person in the firm that can move the needle on the company's success more than the CEO.
Yeah.
100%. And you should be super proud of that opportunity, and you should go after it. And then, okay, so who's with me now? And then you start getting them, okay, now I feel better about sales. I'm willing to go down that route, right?
Well, I did some, I tend not to do any sales training for sellers.
Yeah.
But I quite often find myself getting pulled into sales training, or at least giving people a methodology for non-sellers.
Yes.
And I did some work for a company that does sort of sell side, you know, so sales entrepreneurs businesses. Mm-hmm. These guys are all accountants, and they've all been in Big Four, but now they're in a smaller boutique firm. And so it's sort of 35 of them. And I said, look, I'm here to teach you to sell. Let's talk about sales. And like, we're not interested in learning how to sell. So then we started, I said, park that. If an entrepreneur comes to you with their business,
will you make them more money? Will you sell their business for more than any of your competitors? Like, there's no partners in the room, and they're like, oh yeah, no, there's no doubt that we would work harder and get them more money for this, which is probably a once in a lifetime event.
Yes.
Like, we are passionate and proud about our ability to do that.
Yeah.
I said, okay, well then ethically, I could help you convert more people from no to yes.
Yes.
And they went, oh, that would be great. We'd love to be able to do that.
But it's the same thing.
And so I'm here to help you learn how to influence people. And they're like, oh no, we're very open to learn this.
Yeah.
And it's just really interesting. It. Totally.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I like that.
I just want, before we get into some quick fire questions and some book recommendations, I'm keen to just pick your brains a little bit about the playbook.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know, is the flow always the same? What do you find you have to fill in for people?
Look, a sales playbook, the problem with the sales playbook is it has to be written for each business and each product. And even some businesses who are selling multiple products to multiple clients, each of those lines needs its own playbook.
Mm.
But to start with, your playbook is built up over like getting into sales and experiencing how it works at that business and finding out what the value of their product is to the client.
Uh-huh.
And that value, in our experience, if you don't have something that's giving 10 times more value to your client than what it's costing them, it's not really interesting to bother selling. So you've got to find the value. And value always comes in three forms. How much money can I make my client? How much money can I save them? How much risk can I take off the table?
Yeah. Mm.
And you add those up and I can go into deep discovery and I can find huge value, millions of dollars of value for something that costs 50 grand a year, ARR. Right, so we can go there. And a lot of people struggle to go there, and that's where they're weak. So the sales playbook starts with value, and then it moves into like, what are we selling? How do we sell it? Who do we sell to? And being very focused on choosing who to sell to in the beginning.
Mm.
Militant. Yes. So if I've done five deals with like credit hedge funds who are specifically, you know, in the specific region and they are of a certain size and they are delighted with my product and I know there's another 500 of those guys, I need to go after them. And because JP Morgan wants to talk to me or ICE the exchange or ICAP the interdealer broker wants to talk to me, I'm just going to ignore them.
Yes.
And I'm going to go after those guys because they'll have the same tech stack, they'll have the same kind of legal, the procurement will be similar, the sales cycle will be similar.
Implementation
the problems they're solving are similar. I don't have to have lots of different slides really and lots of different sales messaging. So
they know each other.
They can refer me to their. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, totally. Right? But almost every CEO I meet, like, goes, "Oh, we've sold this deal
to
these
five
guys. Now we've got a deal with HSBC. We've got one of the tier three banks. This we're talking to that exchange. There's a tech company that wants something from us. I'm like, dudes, like really." We've got to focus. What did Amazon and Google do for the first 10, 15 years of their existence? One thing, sold books. Right? That wasn't their goal, to sell books forever. They used that as a tool to learn how to do everything else.
Yeah.
Same with Google, right? Started with search, a blank page, a little box. You could only type something in. No one understood the business model. Focus. You have to focus like relentlessly in the beginning. Otherwise, you run out of money. Because your sales cycle gets very long and messy and you burn a lot of time and energy trying to sell to all those different verticals.
Yes.
And I guess just to add to that, because of the sales cycle, it's wrapping around that. It's giving our clients the science and the art around qualifying out.
Yeah.
And qualifying out really, really early.
Oh, that hurts people.
That hurts.
It's got to be done. And all the time, right?
I did some work with a client a few years ago and I was looking at their success rate and their win rate was about 10%. And I said, I think you've got a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and he said, well, you haven't spoken to anybody yet. I said, I know, but here's what I think's happening. I think you're not qualifying out because your sellers don't want to come to the weekly sales meeting and have nothing in their pipeline.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So they're deliberately quoting for deals they know they can't win.
Yep. Yep.
And they're doing meetings that they shouldn't be doing.
Yep.
Because otherwise they'd be naked.
Correct.
And they don't want to turn up to the meeting naked.
Correct.
And it's like, how can you know that from just that one number? It's like, well, because that number is the wrong number. Like your win rate should be way more than 10%.
Yeah.
Let's go and dig in.
Yeah.
But it's just, yeah, people hate qualifying out.
They hate it. I always say, look, you don't want a fat pipeline with tons of deals and some will close and some won't. You want a skinny pipeline with predictable revenue.
Well, you want to be able to know where we should put some effort.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you don't win deals by accident, right? You like, that's a deal. We need to win it. You're going to have to put some effort in. You can't do that with 10. You might be able to do it with one or two.
Exactly.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Fantastic. Look, let's ask you a couple of quick questions. In a few words, these are all quick questions, not 10-minute answers.
Okay, good.
Yes, James. I'm glad you said that. I'm glad. Yeah. I've been trying to say that to him nicely.
Do you know what I have? I have Matt from Earworm on my shoulder.
Okay, brilliant.
Going, Dom, they're supposed to be quick fire questions, and you don't get quick answers from people. What drives you every day?
Making my customers successful.
Successful customers, 100%, and obsession to learn more.
Okay, yeah. What's your genius?
Endurance cycling, 100%.
People, I love people.
Okay. What unpopular opinion do you hold?
Wow, that's...
In our local pub, there's a sign on the wall that says, please tell the staff about your intolerances. Yeah.
Well, here we go, here we go.
We could be on for a long time.
It could take ages.
Donald Trump might change the world for good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fab.
People who don't contribute to society shouldn't be, contribute to society meaningfully, shouldn't be allowed to shape it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not making a contribution, you don't get a vote.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tough.
tough, man. Or if you're not selling, maybe you shouldn't work here.
Exactly. Yeah.
If your job is in sales. Yeah. Right. Well, what's the most significant risk you've ever taken?
I mean, every time I set up a business, so yeah, it's like raising.
What's your success rate? You're in two that are still alive.
Yeah,
how many have failed?
Probably 50% of the business I've set up have failed, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hard, but you have to walk away, right?
Okay.
Setting up a commodities trading business, trading beer, wine, fruit juice, and sending that from Europe into mainland China, Ningbo. Massive risk. Putting, cash up front into an escrow account and waiting for that shipment to actually come into port at Gaston Shaw. I was sweating.
It was okay.
It was okay, but the supplier was Italian, so it took 6 months to get there.
Yeah.
And the client was Chinese and he wasn't happy.
How do you measure success in life, not in business?
I actually look at my kids. And see how they're doing and what they're going off and what they're achieving. And then the closest ecosystem and the people around me and what I can do to influence their success.
Yeah. Look at your kids and go, man, in spite of my parenting, despite
my parenting, I just want to be in an environment all the time where I'm really like excited and enjoying the conversations, and whether it's with my team at Humble Grape or in the restaurants or the wine team when we're selling wine and building wine or importing wine, or whether it's working with a client at Humble Technology, we have a no arsehole rule. We just want to work with nice people. Life's too short, right? So, like, that's my thing. I want to enjoy what I do, and that's why I'm in an early stage business and not in a big corporation.
I like working with people who have a growth mindset. What is the most recent thing you've learned or skill you've acquired?
Recently I've spent a ton of time working on AI, and I'm using my GPT, and instead of getting vanilla answers back from it, I've uploaded all my ethos and my documentation and my stuff and my sales methodologies that I use, so that when I do stuff now,
it
sounds like me, and it doesn't sound like something like very vanilla and flowery.
Chatting to yourself.
Yeah, although I'm sure some people don't like how I sound. It's a bit brutal.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing I've learned over the last few months, it's a podcast called The Knowledge Project. And there's some really good, interesting conversations around there. And one in particular is the blueprint on how to create a billion-dollar investment company and the framework around that. And specifically, there's a book that they mention around ultra learning, and the methodologies that you can take from that, put them in the business world, in your world, in whatever world it is, and that's in a way transformed my mindset. So it's pretty impactful. And I'm just taking little antidotes from that, and like using it in everyday life.
Fab.
That's pretty cool.
Ultra learning, is that a book by somebody particular or?
Yes, I'll give you the author's name.
We'll put it in the show notes.
I got it on my phone.
What's the biggest myth in business?
The biggest myth, I'm going to hire 10 sales guys and each guy's going to get me $1 million of revenue and that's where my extra 10 million is going to come from next year. That's a spreadsheet. It's a spreadsheet you saw that CEOs love showing to investors. What are you going to do with the money we've just raised? How are you going to get that 10 million next year? Well, I'm going to hire 10 sales guys. Each guy's going to do $1 million in revenue. Okay, excellent. I see that all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not a myth, but the startup grind is bloody real, right?
It's brutal.
It's brutal. And if you don't have the chops for it, don't enter the arena.
Yeah.
Be very thoughtful before you
enter the arena. But the other way around, if you're not standing in the arena, like opening that, starting that business, writing that book, doing the thing, don't be so judgy, you know? I see a lot of people that, you know, everyone wants to write a book or wants to start a business. And then they're very opinionated about people who do start a business or do write a book and it's not quite good enough, right?
Yeah, would be better if I did it, but I haven't done it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, what books should people pick up and read along the way?
At the moment, I'm reading Lencioni's 5 kind of leadership stuff. Patrick Lencioni,
yeah,
you mentioned
5 dysfunctions.
5 dysfunctions, yeah, that's brilliant. Seth Godin, This is Strategy.
Yeah.
Amazing. We do this not because it is easy, but because we think it will be easy. Mm-hmm. I love that quote.
Yeah.
And John McMahon, Qualified Sales Leader. Yeah, I mean, I there's tons of books I'm loving, but those three.
Okay.
I think for me right now, I'm actually reading a couple. One is David Miller, his book, Racing Through Darkness.
Right.
Which is just like insane.
Is this an ultra endurance cycling?
Yeah.
He's blind and he's cycling through the Himalayas.
No. He was part of the Peloton, the Armstrong Peloton era.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And he gets caught, doping in Biarritz. He's chucked into prison cell, and it describes his journey from that to transformational leader and someone that's impacted the sport for the good.
Yeah.
So that's just absolutely insane that someone can do that. I was like, wow.
That's amazing.
Another one is Clear Thinking, again, through the Knowledge Project, which is very interesting, the methodologies and the science that goes into actually thinking clear. And I think sales, business people, everyone out there needs to, take a step back. I mean, I said it a few times today, and just, think clear. How do you do that? The Qualified Sales Leader is another one, and a couple of podcasts I'm listening to. One is super, super interesting, and I recommend everyone to sort of listen to this. It's firstly, the Knowledge Project is interesting, but it's a podcast called Conflicted.
Right.
So Conflicted is a podcast about geopolitics in the Middle East.
Uh-huh.
And it's run by an American historian and an ex-Al-Qaeda spy who was turned, who worked for Osama bin Laden and was turned into an MI5 operative.
Right.
And then was in the Taliban for 9 years as an MI5 operative, and the insights you get from there into the geopolitical situation that's happening around the world right now is just absolutely incredible. Yeah, so there's more, but I'll leave it at that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thanks very much indeed for coming on the show today. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, thanks, awesome. Thanks, Tom. We look forward to some steaks later tonight, right?
Indeed. That'd be brilliant.